morning and welcome. Today, the Young Adults Group will be exploring the theme of spiritual practice and ritual. So the service will revolve largely around active participation. Some of the practices may be familiar to you, while others may be new. Some are adaptations of ancient rituals for a modern religion. For example, the anthem in the round today is based on the Jewish nigun, or repeated melodic line with minimal lyrics designed to calm and open the mind to the divine. We ask that you try each of these new practices with an open mind and an open heart.
Good morning. Thank you guys for coming today. For me, in my spiritual journey that I've been on for not too many years, but considerable number, meditation is a key and integral part. I meditate to find calm, to find peace, and most importantly, to find a connection between myself and the world around me. Today, I would like to invite you all to join in one of my favorite meditations, and it is a great meditation for Unitarian Universalists. The focus of the meditation today is on the connections that we have with each other, with the world around us, in our own minds, and in our hearts. I invite you all to get comfortable, feel grounded, breathe in deeply, and for the next few minutes, we're going to focus on the connections. So allow something to come to mind. Think about it. Allow something else to come with it. The goal of this meditation is to focus on the connection between those two things. If it's etymological, if it's spatial. If, for example, you think of tree first and then you think of hiking, you can think, well, what is the connection between the two? For me, it would be being out in nature. That's the goal of this meditation, is to become more mindful of the connections that we see and experience in the world around us. I invite you to enter a meditation for the next 3 to 5 minutes, and we will end our meditation with the ringing of the bell.
Okay, we're going to do a ritual that embodies our theological and ontological openness, our social vision, our scientific grounding, and our spiritual aspirations. So I'm going to ask you to move a bit, so as you are able, shift in your pews so that you are seated close together. Now if you would, hold out both of your hands, palm up. This is a gesture of openness, of asking and receiving. Now, if this next gesture makes you uncomfortable, it's okay. Ritual, principles, and honest religion often, in integrity, take us out of our comfort zone. So see if you can come into this next step. If you would, keep your left hand open, but with your right hand, place two or more fingers on the wrist of the neighbor to your right. Try to find a pulse. Over here, on the little side under the thumb, if you are unable to find a pulse, it is enough to know that it is there. And if you're on an aisle sitting by yourself, you can place your free fingers on your own wrist. You may close your eyes or not, however you're comfortable. Now I'll ask you to breathe in and exhale slowly, as if you were meditating. And keeping that breath intentional, consider how this gesture recalls our principles, how touch affirms the inherent worth and dignity of every person and compassion in human relations. Consider that through your fingertips, you can feel the pulse of your neighbor. Through your singularity, you touch the life force. Consider how this reveals our fragility, just as it reveals the miracle of the human machine. Finally, take a few breath cycles on your own, increasing your sensitivity to your neighbor's life force. See if you can syncopate your breathing with the rhythm of their heart, and let that syncopation expand in your imagination to include the rhythms of everyone here, and then onward, so that your thoughts turn at last to the interdependent web of all existence and the sum that is greater than all these parts. Listen now to breath and blood and life. At one time, be grounded, be here, transcend. Amen.
It's a pleasure to be up here participating in the Young Adults Worship Service that is exploring spiritual practice. Exploring religious practice has been one of the key interests of the Young Adults group this year. As you may know, Ron Ferris was originally scheduled to lead the service today, but he was unable to attend because he's at the Unitarian Universalist General Assembly in Minneapolis this weekend, and he invited the Young Adults group to lead the service, and we were delighted to take up that invitation. Ron and I have had several long chats about what it means to be a UU and to really do our religion. If I ask you to close your eyes and visualize someone practicing music, it should come pretty naturally. You might have instantly seen someone sitting at a piano bench, reading the sheet music, and playing the melody. But if I ask you to close your eyes and visualize someone practicing our religion, the imagery isn't quite so clear. And so the Young Adults group thought it would be worthwhile to explore the boundaries of religious practice. Some of you might know that my wife and I, Valerie, lived in Saudi Arabia for 3 years. We traveled there to work as teachers because we wanted to see the world and because I was working on a master's degree in the humanities with a focus on Islam. I cannot speak Arabic, and our time in the Islamic world was limited, so I'm not going to claim to be an expert, but I did immerse myself as much as I could, and thanks to a profound friendship with a Saudi who opened doors that are normally closed to Westerners, I did get to worship alongside my Muslim brothers in Saudi Arabia and a handful of other Muslim countries. And so I'd like to share a few things I learned about the religious practices of Muslims. Regardless of whether you believe that Muhammad was spoken to by the angel Gabriel, I think that you too might see some value in the religious practices that he instituted amongst the tribes of the Arabian Peninsula 1,400 years ago, strange as that may sound. And please note I'm talking about religious practices here, not an endorsement of his perspective on God or Sharia or so forth. What I'm talking about are the religious practices that I like to visualize as a big clock with gears of different sizes. The smallest gear represents Islamic prayer, and it rotates, and it comes to the same spot 5 times a day. As you may know, Muslims are instructed to pray 5 times per day. So 5 times, they take a break from their daily activities and join together into worship their experience of the holy. The next gear, much larger, represents a lunar year. And as it rotates for 1/12 of that cycle, the month of Ramadan, Muslims fast during the daylight hours, and according to our experiences, they binge during the twilight hours. The next gear, part of this clock of spiritual practices of Islam, represents a lifespan. And one time during a Muslim's life, they are enjoined to go on to the pilgrimage to Hajj, where everyone gathers together at a particular time of the year. You may have seen it. Millions of people come together to worship on Mount Arafat and do various rituals that are just part of this experience. These three practices serve in different ways and in different emphasis to draw Muslims back to their worship of the holy. Daily, in a small remembrance. Annually, for a month of remembrance that requires some discipline. And then once in a lifetime that really requires you to travel across the world and worship with your religious compatriots. These three practices, along with the practice of zakat, or charitable giving, form 4 of the 5 pillars of Islam. The 5th pillar is the shahada, ashhadu la ilaha illallah wa ashhadu anna muhammadan abduhu wa rasulullah, which means, I testify that there is no deity but God, the one God, and Muhammad is his prophet. It's interesting to note that 4 of the 5 pillars of Islam are practices, and quite demanding practices. Now, of course, the first is that testimony, and it's a very important one, so I don't want to minimize that. But 4 of the 5 pillars are these practices, asking you to do something. And ideally, you know, it would have been nice to have us try a practice. Muslim prayer would have been interesting for us to try, but the situation of our space here doesn't really allow it. It's a prostration. It requires some space for us to do. So I'm just going to talk a little bit about it. The Quran, the holy book of Muslims, doesn't specify exactly how to do the prayers or exactly when. It does, however, mention repeatedly how important it is to take this time out to pray. The details came from the way Prophet Muhammad lived his life, and so people imitated the way he prayed, and thus the practice established itself. And the way that Muhammad prayed is actually similar to the way many Orthodox Jews or Christians pray, or even some Buddhists in Korea, and that is in prostration. And the Bible, when it talks about the prophets, it talks about how they prayed in prostration. So Joshua fell on his face to the earth and did worship. Moses and Aaron fell upon their faces. In Genesis, Abraham fell upon his face. And of course, in Matthew 26:39, Jesus came forth and fell on his face and prayed. Those are just a few examples, and there are many more. Although prostration may seem very strange to us today, and I can understand that it is strange, especially like in an airport or some places, it makes people wonder what's going on. In the world where Islam was born, a world of tents and cushions for sitting and all this kind of stuff, this was the natural way that people prayed. The question that I want to look at is, what could we perhaps discover in the practice of benefit to us in the practice of Islamic prayer? And I'm not talking necessarily about prostration, but I'm more talking about taking the time out. By having prayer spread throughout the day, one is always involved in remembering the holy. You start your day remembering the holy, and you end your day remembering the holy. And in the span of the day, at least three times, you remember what is important to you. In many ways, setting aside time for prayer is like setting aside time for meditation. It creates a break in the continuous demands of living. I wonder how many people here today accepted the invitation to cleanse themselves before coming into the sanctuary. Could I just see a show of hands? Who actually tried it? Terrific. So if you're anything like me, you would have found this refreshing. You get the benefits of jumping into a shower without quite the full shock. And imagine a busy day at work, one of those days where it's 2 p.m. and you haven't had a chance to get lunch yet. And imagine now that you and your office had established the practice of just stopping at noon and quickly cleansing your face, your arms, your hair in cold water, and setting aside a few minutes to worship whatever is truly meaningful in your life. What do you suppose the effect would be on your daily conduct, if any, if you did this regularly? If I could make a comparison with Buddhism, the Buddha taught the great importance of mindfulness. Meditating at specific times can help you to lead a mindful life. We are too often swept away with our material day-to-day affairs. Muslims, when they pray at the prescribed times, are coming back to their soul, back to their experience of the holy. It can be a collective, mindful meditation that helps one to remember who you are and where you belong in the scheme of things. One of the religious currents that excites me and gives me great hope is the liberal movement within Islam. This movement heartily accepts the pillars of Islam, but interprets the Quran in a cultural and historical context. I think that we as UU should reach out to this community. We have much to offer in partnership with the growing liberal Islamic movement, and I think if we're open and curious, there's a lot for us to learn, especially with regard to establishing practices that deepen our faith. Thank you.
Om is a sacred symbol in Indian religions. It is not just a visual symbol, but a sound made up of three phonemes, A, O, M. Chanting Om is an important spiritual practice in many religious traditions, including Hinduism, Buddhism, Jainism, and Sikhism. Om has different meanings in the various traditions, and I am by no means an expert on any of them, but I will share with you some of the different thoughts about Om. In some traditions, Om is a symbol of God and the singularity or oneness of God. In other traditions, the three sounds are said to represent the three manifestations of God or Brahman: Brahma or creation, Vishnu or preservation, and Shiva or destruction. It is also considered the sound that was present at the creation of the universe. According to another philosophy, our current existence is falsehood, and in order to know the full truth, we must comprehend
beyond the body and intellect, the true nature of infinity. When one gains true knowledge, there is no split between knower and known. One becomes knowledge consciousness itself. In essence, Om is the signifier of the ultimate truth that all is one. Up until a few months ago, I had a regular yoga practice at Dharma Yoga, which I intend to go back to at the end of the summer. Dharma Yoga is one of the only, if not the only, Buddhist yoga studio in Austin. There we begin and end our yoga practice with chanting Om together. For me, this helps consecrate the time as a spiritual practice instead of just an hour and a half of exercise. When chanting, I meditate on the knowledge that the energy that makes up me and everything else in the room, in the world, and in the universe is connected. The ground beneath me stretches out, connecting all the people and life that sits upon this earth. I imagine that the sound vibrations that we make together reverberate out through the universe. I try to feel the connection and not just think it. One of the variations that we do at Dharma to end the practice is chanting Om in round. To do this, we all take a deep breath together and then blow it out. And with the next breath, we all begin Om together. As each person ends their Om, they do not wait for everyone else, but immediately take another breath and begin chanting Om again. So everyone's then, after the first Om, is starting their own Oms at different times. We do this for about a minute. When the gong is struck, everyone does not stop immediately, but finishes the Om that they are on. We are going to try this together today. I know that trying something new can be a bit nerve-wracking. Please participate as you feel comfortable, but know that no one next to you is judging your Om. The volume or the length or the pitch. We are all in community together, being compassionate to ourselves, to each other, and the world at large. So remember, we are going to begin the chant on the second deep breath. And when we finish our Om, don't wait for everyone else. Just take a deep breath and begin again. When you hear the gong, don't stop immediately. Just finish the Om that you're on so it'll sort of fade. All right, so please close your eyes and get comfortable. Now take a deep breath in and blow it out. With this next breath, we will begin. Thank you, Valerie, for that. That was really beautiful. Between the head and the hands, there is the heart. That's the last line of Metropolis, a silent film directed by political activist and philosopher Fritz Lang. Lang recognized that philosophy, in and of itself, cannot move us to action without the energy of heart behind it. Between high ideals and acting for justice, Lang argued, there must be something that moves us, something fervent and furious. Without heart, the head drives the hands dispassionately. This, Lang depicts in his film, leads either to cruelty or to exhaustion. Now, we UUs do the head bit really well. And we're not half bad at the hand bit either. Where we're lacking is heart. While UUs excel at religious discourse and at social and political action, we are often seen as cold or elitist in our intellectualism, both by outsiders and within our own ranks. And part of the reason why this may be is that we don't have a standardized base of ritual, especially communally enacted ritual. Ritual offers the benefit of expressing emotions in a social space and gives us a script and a direction for doing so. In this way, ritual forms a container for feelings that arise out of life's inevitable struggles and joys. We UUs feel this very acutely, and we young adults feel this very acutely, as many of us are undergoing some of life's most confusing transitions, joining our lives with another in union or marriage, welcoming new children into our lives, watching our parents and our grandparents begin to decline or pass away, graduating from school, starting on careers or life goals, recognizing our own independent personhood and our place in a broader community. People move to religion during these times precisely because of the confusing emotions that those transitions invoke. Through religious ritual, emotions that are raw or intense start to dissipate. Emotions that are ambiguous or confusing become articulated and clarified. And emotions that seem mundane or that we take for granted, like gratitude or peacefulness, take on the deeper meaning that they deserve. That is what makes rituals beautiful and powerful. And that is what makes rituals dangerous. Because when emotions are harnessed, people are capable of believing just about anything or nothing at all. In the absence of careful thought, ritual can become dogmatic and false. Because ritual by its nature requires little thought, there is the danger that it can lead to a habit of mindlessness. And that's just about as close to a UU sin as we could possibly get. So this is our charge, us UUs. We must adapt or create spiritual practices for our religious community that serve the major functions of ritual. That is, to open ourselves up to ourselves and to one another, to share our human experience on a non-intellectual level, without giving up our ideal for the responsible search for meaning. Now, in the service today, we took a step towards that goal in experimenting with a number of new spiritual practices, and we hope that this is just one step that leads to many. I ask you in the days ahead to think about the spiritual practices, both traditional and entirely new, which have served you in the past, and then to share them with one another. Pursue the meaning and the history of the rituals that you use or have always wanted to use and try them out. There's no reason not to be a scientist about it. Track your feelings before and after. Do statistical analyses if you have to. The important thing is to share new spiritual practices with one another, especially in your fellowship groups if possible, or to examine the practices that you use regularly for signs of habit, spiritual wear and tear, as it were. Somewhere along the line, you may find that you've stumbled into a new land, somewhere between the head and the hands. Our parting words today come from Robert F. Kaufman. We have come together to share our deepest concerns, speaking and singing words of inspiration and hope. We have committed ourselves to do what we can to ease the burdens of those who suffer, to stand for decency and compassion. We have pledged to work for a more wholesome environment for us and for all the generations that follow. But these are just words. The hymns we sing are just songs. All of our reflections are just idle thoughts. When we convert them all into loving and responsible action throughout the week, then, and only then, will this morning be what we want it to be, a time of worship.
This is a presentation of the First Unitarian Universalist Church of Austin. For more information, visit our website at www.austinuu.org.